Chapter 4. "And so I said," said Harry Seldon, "that will mark the beginning of the fall of the Galactic Empire." "And so it will, Dawes." Dawes listened tight-lipped. She accepted Seldon's first ministership as she accepted everything, calmly. Her only mission was to protect him and his psycho-history, but that task, she well knew, was made harder by his position. The best security was to go unnoticed, and as long as the spaceship and sun, the symbol of the Empire, shone down upon Seldon, all of the physical barriers in existence would be unsatisfactory. The luxury in which they now lived, the careful shielding from spy beams, as well as from physical interference, the advantages to her own historical research of being able to make use of nearly unlimited funds, did not satisfy her. She would gladly have exchanged it all for their old quarters at Streeling University, or better yet, for a nameless apartment in a nameless sector where no one knew them. "That's all very well, Harry dear," she said, "but it's not enough."
"What's not enough?"
"The information you're giving me. You say we might lose the periphery. How? Why?"
Seldon smiled briefly.
"How nice it would be to know, Dawes. But psychohistory is not yet at the stage where it could tell us." "In your opinion, then, is it the ambition of local faraway governors to declare themselves independent?"
"Well, that's a factor, certainly. It's happened in past history, as you know, far better than I. But never for long. Maybe this time it will be permanent."
"Because the Empire is weaker?"
"Yes, because trade flows less freely than it once did, because communications are stiffer than they once were, because the governors in the periphery are, in actual fact, closer to independence than they have ever been. If one of them arises with particular ambitions..."
"Can you tell me which one it might be?"
"Not in the least. All we can force out of psycho-history at this stage is the definite knowledge that if a governor of unusual ability and ambition arises, he would find conditions more suitable for his purposes than he would have in the past. It could be other things, too, some great natural disaster or some sudden civil war between two distant outer-world coalitions. None of that can be precisely predicted as of now, but we can tell that anything of the sort that happens will have more serious consequences than it would have had a century ago."
"But if you don't know a little more precisely what will happen in the periphery, how can you so guide actions as to make sure the periphery goes rather than Trantor?"
"By keeping a close eye on both and trying to stabilize Trantor and not trying to stabilize the periphery. We can't expect psychohistory to order events automatically without much greater knowledge of its workings, so we have to make use of constant manual controls, so to speak. In days to come, the technique will be refined, and the need for manual control will decrease."
"But that," said Dawes, "is in days to come, right?"
"Right. And even that is only a hope."
"And just what kind of instabilities threaten Trantor, if we hang on to the periphery?"
"The same possibilities. Economic and social factors, natural disasters, ambitious rivalries among high officials, and something more. I have described the Empire to Hugo as being overheated, and Trantor is the most overheated portion of all. It seems to be breaking down. The infrastructures, water supply, heating, waste disposal, fuel lines, everything, seems to be having unusual problems, and that's something I've been turning my attention to more and more lately."
"What about the death of the Emperor?"
Seldon spread his hands.
"Well, that happens inevitably. But Cleon is in good health. He's only my age. Which I wish was younger, but he isn't too old. His son is totally inadequate for the succession, but there will be enough claimants, more than enough to cause trouble and make his death distressing. But it might not prove a total catastrophe in the historic sense."
"Let's say his assassination, then."
Seldon looked up nervously. "Don't say that. Even if we're shielded, don't use the word.
Harry, don't be foolish. It's an eventuality that must be reckoned with. There was a time when the Geronimites might have taken power, and if they had, the Emperor, one way or another..."
"Probably not. He would have been more useful as a figurehead, and in any case, forget it. Geronim died last year on Nishaya, a rather pathetic figure."
"He had followers."
"Of course, everyone has followers. Did you ever come across the globalist party on my native world of Helicon in your studies of the early history of the Kingdom of Trantor and of the Galactic Empire?"
"No, I haven't."
"I don't want to hurt your feelings, Harry, but I don't recall coming across any piece of history in which Helicon played a role. I'm not hurt, Dawes. Happy the world without a history, I always say. In any case, about 2,400 years ago, there arose a group of people on Helicon who were quite convinced that Helicon was the only inhabited globe in the universe. Helicon was the universe, and beyond it there was only a solid sphere of sky speckled with tiny stars. How could they believe that? Said Dawes. They were part of the Empire, I presume. Yes, but globalists insisted that all evidence to the effect that the Empire existed was either illusion or deliberate deceit, that Imperial emissaries and officials were Heliconians playing a part for some reason. They were absolutely immune to reason. And what happened? I suppose it's always pleasant to think that your particular world is the world. At their peak, the globalists may have persuaded 10% of the population of the planet to be part of the movement. Only 10%, but they were a vehement minority that drowned out the indifferent majority and threatened to take over. But they didn't, did they? No, they didn't. What happened was that globalism caused a diminishing of imperial trade, and the Heliconian economy slid into the doldrums. When the belief began to affect the pocketbooks of the population, it lost popularity rapidly. The rise and fall puzzled many at the time, but psychohistory, I'm sure, would have shown it to be inevitable, and would have made it unnecessary to give it any thought. I see. But, Harry, what is the point of the story? I presume there's some connection with what we were discussing. The connection is that such movements never completely die, no matter how ridiculous their tenets may seem to sane people. Right now, on Helicon, right now, there are still globalists. Not many, but every once in a while, 70 or 80 of them, get together in what they call a global congress and take enormous pleasure in talking to each other about globalism. Well, it's only 10 years since the Geronimite movement seemed such a terrible threat to this world, and it would not be at all surprising if there weren't still some remnants left. There may still be some remnants 1,000 years from now. Isn't it possible that a remnant may be dangerous? I doubt it. It was Jojo's charisma that made the movement dangerous, and he's dead. He didn't even die a heroic death, or one that was in any way remarkable. He just withered away and died in exile, a broken man. Dawes stood up and walked the length of the room quickly, swinging her arms at her sides and clenching her fists. She returned and stood before the seated Selden. Harry, she said, let me speak my mind. If psychohistory points to the possibility of serious disturbances on Trantor, then if there are Geronimites still left, they may still be plotting the Emperor's death. Selden laughed nervously. You jump at shadows, Dawes. Relax. But he found that he could not dismiss what she had said quite that easily.